The editorial in the Toronto Star this morning was a crackerjack. You think the sermon is finished, but of course it's never finished when it's on the page, and it's never finished when you deliver it. It takes its place in the ear of the hearers and finishes sometime down the road for all of us. But here was a little piece I hadn't expected. I even cut it out. I never cut anything out of the paper. I cut this out. And if you have the Star at home and you haven't looked at it, take a look. It says in part, "More than anything, perhaps, Christmas reminds us of the power of story in human experience, the need and genius of men, women, and children for narrative in finding meaning and inspiration. Words of the event would have spread only as fast as one set of lips would impart it to another's ears, only as fast as a man or woman could walk or donkey trot. It was decades before the story was even recorded, and then in several versions. So the most humanity who would have moved and been enriched by it, the birth of Christ, came only as a story. It had to be taken on faith, yet that story spoke so profoundly to men and women that for better or for worse, it changed the course of history, made Jesus Christ the single most influential figure in the history of Western civilization." Fred, in A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, declared, "Christmas is a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time, the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow travelers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on their journeys." At its core, C.S. Lewis has written, "Christianity is the ultimate second chance. It's about forgiveness and redemption. It has nothing to say," Lewis wrote, "to people who do not know they have anything to repent of and who do not feel they need any forgiveness." That's a good piece. I'm going to keep it and read it again and again. The keys to the strong house. Well, do you know that the strongest house we ever have is the one in which we fortify ourselves to resist God? Now, that sounds strange, especially when our hearts are open in the Christmas season, but that's the strongest house we have, the one we fortify in which to resist God. It's part of a healthy human life to resist God. That is to sit loosely to the mystery of God for a while. It's what children need to do to break away even from the most loving of parents and to find their relationship growing richer in themselves and then returning in a more magnanimous and gifted way to the ones who love them so much. It's part of a healthy life to resist the sacred, to be hesitant about it, to be reticent about it, to be a slow starter when it comes to divine things. Are you a slow starter when it comes to God? Beware any fanatics, or beware any ones who are too sure or seem smitten beyond reason. They have been infected by something. It may be something wonderful, but it certainly is not the whole story for them or for us. A strong house is what we have. Now, a strong house has motion detectors, and they work very well. Someone says to you, "Are you saved?" And the motion detectors go, something here is a little bit unusual. And we have a high fence as well. I like to tend my own garden in divine things. I don't want your little seeds and weeds drifting over from your side of the line. I will work on my own hedgerows. Thank you. And it has a gate as well. We say, if you're coming to speak to us about holy things, talk to the doorman first, will you? Some ideas will be welcome here, and some will not be in my life, and I have a list, and the doorman has a list. Please honor it, we say. I remember being at the cottage a few years ago, just starting my summer holidays, out there in my shorts and my sandals and picking away at things, and suddenly two young men showed up with white shirts and ties and long pants, and I thought, I know who these people are, and they asked me if I knew where I was going to be when tomorrow came. I said, yes, I'm going to be tending my cottage here, and you lads are going to be a long way from here because I do this all year, and I don't need to do it on my summer holidays. Have a nice day. The strong house has closed doors as well, until I decide to open them. I like a measure of mystery, you see, and I don't want people telling me what my mystery about God means. I can peek out curtained windows. They can't see in. I can see out, and I like it that way. And my strong house has rooms for specific things in it. I can eat food in one and think thoughts in another and find intimacy and rest in still another and find playfulness and solace in another. Now, if I were to place this strong house in a gated community of other strong and separate houses, then resistance to the holy is almost guaranteed. Almost. The key to the strong house is found in one word, and the word is incarnation. The definition is a person who embodies in the flesh a deity, a spirit, or an abstract quality. Now, we recognize incarnation. It's a human thing to recognize incarnation. We see it. We may not know what to do with it. And some cultures want to kill it. And some cultures want to worship it. And some cultures want to follow it. And some cultures want to befriend it. Even friends and enemies of our own know what to make of incarnation. We see it. Patty Orr, our resident poet, writes, "We did not give life to ourselves, but born in wonder, grow slowly out of ourselves and turn and change and are no closer to the meaning till we find we are growing deep inside another. The insidious, unshakable blessing of incarnation, the key to the strong house." Now, we find this moment in the story of King David. Did you hear it when it was so beautifully read? The author in the story needs to move King David from his strong house, that is his mirrored room in which he reads all his own press clippings and feels very good about himself, through the gate and out onto the street. So listen to the power of the storyteller as he spins his tale. David, he says, is resting from his enemies. I thought, what a transitory moment that is. If we have enemies, they're not going to quit the first time. Satan and Christ fought with each other, says the tale, until the end of life. And even though Satan bailed out on one occasion, he was waiting at the edge of the scene to walk back in on yet another. So there is King David sitting in the glory and in the glow of his trophy room, wondering about how his life could be so great. And then in a moment of misguided largesse, says the storyteller, King David decides to give God a treat. He says, "I'm going to build God a house to mirror the splendor of my own house." I think that's something I, as a great king, should be honored to do. "There will be high ceilings for worship," he says, "and there will be ensuite bathrooms in the place, and a great banquet hall in which God can entertain all God's friends, and a fully stocked larder and wireless music in every room. One command, one clap of the hands, and God can bring on the symphony orchestra or a folk song or anything God likes. The lights will dim or they'll grow brighter on demand. It will be spectacular." And Nathan, the prophet, is David's yes man, you see. And Nathan says, "This is going to be a really good idea, sire. One of your best ideas." "Yes, you go with that idea. I can't wait to see it, old sire. You have the best ideas, oh my lord." And later at night, Nathan is awakened and he hears the voice of God say to him, "Have I ever asked for a house? Am I to be confined in somebody's designated reception rooms, a high-walled house in some gated community, in a jumped-up neighborhood, in a passing culture? Am I?" says God. "I am a veteran," he says. "I suffer from PTSD, says God. "I've carried crying slaves out of Egypt. I've tasted blood in rebellions. I've stood by Moses' side in Pharaoh's throne room. You try that for your king. I have sand in my shoes, and I have salt on my shins, and I have nightmares from the wilderness, and I have dreams of promised land in my head. I am a basket case, if you like, a cornucopia of blessings, says God. I carry the blueprint of lands unseen for you and for all right inside my mind, says God. You tell the king I live in a tent, says God. Thin walls, I hear everything. Easily transportable, I am everywhere. I live in the very heart of my people. You tell the king, I will build a house out of him. That's different. He shall be my tent. I shall speak and act through his presence and the afterglow of his incarnation. His offspring will carry his legend to the ends of the earth when I am finished with him. Tell him that when his mortal walls grow thin and he fades away, he will grow fat and prosperous in the annals of all faithful people all over the world. You tell him, God says to Nathan. Well, it's called incarnation, the embodiment in flesh of a deity, spirit, or abstract quality. The task of God's creative spirit, and here it is to unlock the stronghold in which we live, to move us to an experience to touch the work of God inside our own flesh. That's the whole purpose of God's spirit in the living world. Life is on the street, it's in the flow, we meet it in others as incarnation. That is how the holy get things done. No safe house, no strong house, just life out there in the flow. Now swing over to the story of Luke's overture, chapters 1 and 2 of Luke's gospel. In the overture, Luke lays out all the themes he's going to bring us in the rest of his story. In the stories of Elizabeth and Mary, Luke is expressing his understanding of incarnation, the key to the strong house. Luke has no interest in the biological fertility of Elizabeth's body in old age. No interest. This is not a story about gynecology. Nor has he interest in the sexual practices of a young couple before they're married. This is not a story about obstetrics. These stories are about the power of the mission that's going to unfold in the rest of the gospel, a portrait of the headwaters from which all our blessings are going to flow. Elizabeth and Zechariah are the culmination of ancient Israel. Incarnate in them are the thoughts and the rituals and the memories of God's chosen people. The messianic seed, the promise for the future, is resting inside their old frames and will become incarnate in John the Baptist, their child, by a miracle of God's grace. And then in Mary and Joseph, and be careful because names are important here, Mary and Joseph, the next chapter recalls what is going to be born, the new age linking to the old one. Joseph, there's the name, recalls Joseph the dreamer in the Old Testament story. Remember the favorite son who was sold by his brothers into slavery and who by the gift of his dreams saved his people from starvation and annihilation. And Miriam, Mary, in the Old Testament is the sister of Moses, called one of the seven great women prophets who led the people out of slavery. There are the models through which the new is going to come. Vision, daring, and new possibility lie just under the skin. Mary will become a fresh chapter, a golden particularity in a much older and broader story. There it is, Luke's overture on incarnation. Her keen flesh and willing spirit are a harbor for incarnation, writes Luke. John will be a wall in the tent of God. Jesus will be a door in the tent of God, and around them over the years, we will hang writings and portraits and poetry and vision and courage. Patty Orr, our poet, writes, "My altar is not where I kneel. It is where I stand tallest, sing loudest, and love most bravely. My God confronts me eye to eye and dares me look away or faint or fade, knowing that I would find upon my knees a safer posture, little bruising, and not a trace of blood. John and Jesus are the incarnation of the majesty, purpose, and power of God, carrying in themselves the keys to the strong house, and they're coming to get you. They're coming to get Christmas. Is not back there. It's right here, right at the door. They're coming to get you with the key, sizing up your defenses all the time until your life breaks through into the grace and reality of the God who loves you and calls your name, spreading their truths like exploding seed pods all across your neatly manicured lawn until you see strange things growing you never expected there. Incarnation is the tracking you down and the blessing of your life. Sounds amazing, doesn't it? Sounds frightening, doesn't it? Well, have you seen The Fixer Upper? It's a show on HGTV, and my wife and I, if we're not watching something like Midsummer Murders on Netflix, can you imagine living in Midsummer? There are more murders there per capita than Chicago. But we watch it every night, and it's quite wonderful to see all those people being killed in Britain. But when we're not watching that, we watch The Fixer Upper, and it's the story of a company called Magnolia Homes, run by Chip and Joanna Gaines from Waco, Texas. And they're a happy-go-lucky couple. They really love each other, and they bring their young children into the program towards the end of each show, and the children help mother decorate the place. They find run-down houses, which are going to become dream houses for the people they bring on board, and the couple chooses a house, and then the two of them, Joanna and Chip, go to work on the thing, and after a little while, the fixer-upper becomes the magical dream home. And at the end, with a screen across, they say to the couple, "You want to see your fixer-upper?" And all the television watchers, including the two of us sitting across Canada, are leaning forward in our seats saying, "Yes, yes." And they open up the screen, and there is this magnificent house there, and everybody's happy, and it makes for a great day, and life feels good, and you've forgotten all those people that were shot dead in Britain. Well, the show has been running for 5 years, and this year will be the last of it on HGTV. And Waco, Texas has seen a change since then as well. 5 years ago, the number of tourists who went to Waco, Texas was 660,000 a year. And because of the show, The Fixer Upper, the total is now 1.9 million visitors a year. And they own their own place, do the Gaines. It's a farmstead. It, too, is in process. And you see them every week climbing up to the top of a tower and repairing it. Never seems to be finished. And they raise their children there. And the reason they're giving up the show, lucrative as it is that they say they do not want their children to grow up in the spotlight of artificial fame. They want their children to know the blessings and the joys of quiet family life, and they will be raised on the farm, and they will enjoy their life as a family together. Incarnation does that. It moves us from a desire for notoriety, as seen in King David, to a desire to bring something into birth and to nurture it in its beauty until it shines. We need to go there, to the place of incarnation. Indeed, we're almost there, because in Christmas, the Almighty God, the warrior, the tent dweller, is coming with the keys to the strong house to break into our lives and be born in us today. Incarnation, a deity, a spirit, or an abstract quality embodied in the flesh. It happens. It's all around us. We see it with open eyes, the key to the strong house.